This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think that's a big part of what we need to start thinking about in general, whether it's water in the Rockies or skiing, is we need to find new ways to talk about this. We need to find people with courage, with vision, with imagination for the future. And there are people like that out there. It's not just doomsayers or business as usual people. There are lots of smart, especially young people who've grown up with global warming their whole life, who do have ideas.
As we embark upon a new decade, many of us are contemplating ongoing environmental challenges and what may be in store for the Earth in the decade to come. Fortunately, there are some excellent journalists out there with their fingers on the pulse, whose mission is to uncover environmental news both alarming and inspiring. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're checking in with Bob Berwin, an Austrian-based environmental journalist who writes for Inside Climate News, and is in the midst of a three-month tour of the western United States and Mexico. Berwin discusses the fragile ecosystems west of the Rockies, tells us about permaculture in Oaxaca, and examines the ethical dilemmas that both skiers and ski resorts are facing as the planet warms and snowfall becomes less consistent. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bob Berwin. He's an environmental journalist and writes for Inside Climate News. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
You're an American based in Austria, but you're doing a three-month tour of the Southwest states as well as Mexico and looking at some very fragile ecosystems in a new way. Why don't you kind of give us a background on what's the mission of this three-month tour that you're taking with your family?
I wanted to revisit some places that I had lived and that I care about a lot, Colorado and Mono Lake in Eastern California, and look at them through the lens of climate impacts. And so I wanted to see how global warming is affecting these places already, how it's going to affect them in the future, and most importantly, what people living in those areas are doing or can do to create healthy, resilient, and sustainable communities in the face of the changes that we're seeing.
So let's start with the Rocky Mountains and the Southern Colorado River Basin. This is an area that's just gorgeous, and it's also gets a lot of snow generally, but it's a fragile area. What are some of the biggest pushes and pulls that this ecosystem is facing?
Well, global warming has already significantly affected snowpacks throughout the Rockies, throughout the western mountains of the United States. So there's been a big shift in when the snow falls, how much snow falls, where the snow line is. And that then affects the how much water is available, not just for the immediate area, but for, you know, a much wider region that depends on that water. Stream flows in the Colorado River have already been significantly decreased because of global warming, and that's expected to continue into the future. The Southwest, the Four Corners area, so that includes parts of Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, has been pretty much under a 20-year drought. And the other things that are happening there is, Colorado is warming up quite a bit faster than a lot of other parts of the U.S., which leads to much drier conditions. We've seen a lot of beetle kill. Forests dying because of drought weakens the trees, and those trees are then more susceptible to fires. So we've had a series of what some people call mega fires throughout the region, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, all within the last 10 to 15 years or so during that extended drought period.
And when we're looking at trying to reverse some of these effects, obviously climate change and snow cover, these are longer term things that we can affect in a longer term view. But in the shorter term, what I'm hearing is that it all comes back to water. We had Jamie Redford on, a filmmaker who had done a piece about the Colorado River Basin called Watershed. And so much of this is man-made disaster in terms of our agricultural needs and trying to feed population centers that are very far away from where the snow is falling. What are some of the shorter term solutions that you encountered in your research that might be able to kind of scale back some of the crises we're seeing in this region?
Good question. In terms of water, I think, you know, we have to fundamentally rethink the way that we treat water as a resource and see it as a precious gift more than seeing it as just purely a commodity, and understand on an individual level and on a societal level. More specifically, I think we have to do things like change irrigation practices. We have to practice more water conservation. We have to change our expectations, all of us, in terms of what we think we need and what we actually need. And I'll be really specific about that. A heck of a lot of water goes to agriculture. The majority of the water from the Colorado River goes to agriculture. A lot of that goes to growing alfalfa, and a significant amount of that alfalfa is, let's say, exported to China, for example, to feed cattle there, feed livestock. And in, a little closer to home, you know, I question whether we can sustain a food system where we have the expectation of having all sorts of fresh produce 365 days a year by irrigating huge areas of desert. And, you know, maybe it'd be worth thinking about that a little bit and just changing our expectations a little bit.
Slightly tangential discussion, but I think it's relevant to what we're talking about in this mountainous region of the Western U.S. There's a piece on Inside Climate News from late October called Turning Skiers into Climate Voters with the Advocacy Potential of the NRA. And it's not a piece that you did, but I'd be interested in your opinion on what's happening there. Maybe you can kind of give us an overview of the conundrum that the ski industry faces. I mean, this is an industry that lives and dies off of snow and people who love the outdoors. They have the money to try to make inroads in advocacy, but they also are in love with a sport that's essentially not great for the environment.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. I think that was a really powerful piece by Judy Fahey's. And I think we need every advocacy group that we can get. And I do think that skiers have the potential to be a voting block. And we have to mobilize everybody, you know, to vote in a way that will change the system, the sort of the treadmill that we're on right now. We have to break out of that. We have to break out of that system. Specifically to the ski industry, I think their efforts to mobilize are good. I think there are some really strong efforts out there. I'll name Vail Resorts as a company that has a very specific target and plan to be climate or carbon neutral by 2030. And I wish them all the best. Some of the problems I see is that they're trying to meet this challenge a lot with technology, which means specifically artificial snowmaking. And that is quickly going to run into a sort of a dead end, because at some point, and there are studies that show this, the temperatures are going to be too warm even for snowmaking, especially at mid and lower elevation resorts. So there's a lot of geographical nuance in that too. So you have to be careful not to overgeneralize.
Yes, I've seen some of the strategies that some of the lower elevated resorts are taking on. Most notably, I'm thinking of North Star Resort, which is owned by Vail. North Star is not the highest mountain in Tahoe, but in order to try to keep that revenue going, irrespective of snowfall, they're building up these areas to make them all year round family type destinations with movie theaters and like little malls and just shopping all over the place and building up these areas that are supposed to be pristine. You can understand why they want to do that, but I don't know if that's necessarily the carbon neutral goal that would be included in something by a Vail ski company. They may say they're carbon neutral, but they're part and parcel with this strategy to try to continue to be profitable despite not having as much snow to work with.
That's clearly one of the main adaptation strategies of the ski industry worldwide, is to shift to a year-round model. I think other things they're going to have to do is to, if they want to keep skiing as part of their business model, is at some point, you know, change again. We have to talk about changing expectations, and we may reach a point where only 1 year out of three offers snow good enough to ski. So people who are used to taking an annual ski trip are, you know, it just may not be possible by 2050 based on the path that we're on and the temperature projections that we're on, snowmaking or no snowmaking. In terms of the development side of it, I don't really know what to say. I mean, if Vail Resorts can operate their systems so that they're carbon neutral, you know, if they want to have alpine slides in the summer on limited areas, I hate to see the mountains overdeveloped as well, and I choose not to visit places like that, pretty much.
How does it differ in Austria, which has some of the best mountains in Europe and a deep skiing tradition?
Yeah, no, it's very similar. Again, there's a lot of nuance. There are scores of ski areas in Austria that have already closed, lower elevation resorts. In general, a lot of the ski areas that are at lower elevation are much lower than in the U.S. And a lot of them have just closed, period. You know, they just don't operate anymore. In the apartment building where we live, there was an old sled standing in the basement, and I was talking to a neighbor, and he said, yeah, that's mine. And, well, gosh, I haven't used it in 20 years. I used to sled here around here every winter, and I haven't used it in the last 20 years because there hasn't been enough snow. The bigger mega resorts in Austria, like the Arlberg region, for example, are pursuing the exact same strategy as Vail Resorts, massive investments in snowmaking. And the other thing they're doing here that's quite controversial, or in Austria, I should say, is they're expanding onto glacier areas, which are shrinking in and of themselves, you know, trying to sort of retreat uphill, I guess would be the way to describe it, thinking that those are going to be sort of the last refuge areas for skiing, higher elevation and with at least some ice underneath. But all that is, you know, very short to medium term. I mean, we're talking, you know, a few more decades, basically, of extending the model before even those glaciers will have diminished to the point where that's not really going to be a viable option anymore. And they're also trying to build up more summer business. Maybe one of the big differences is that there's sort of a conscious effort that's actually somewhat sort of steered and coordinated by the government, a conscious acknowledgement that climate change is an issue that poses an economic threat, and here's some ways you can adapt. And if I can add one more thing, some of the alternate options that I've come across in the last couple of years in looking at this and reporting on it is there are people working with communities to develop alternatives called soft tourism to try and actively encourage them to move away from lift-served skiing to ski touring. So there are several areas now in Austria and Italy where there are no lifts, and they're sort of, you know, kind of going with the flow, so to say. Instead of fighting climate change, they're going with it and saying, well, yeah, some years the ski touring is going to be good, and other years maybe we'll have mountain biking through December, you know. And
may not be as profitable, but it's a lot better for the planet.
Yeah, well, I think they're still planning on running the lifts and doing downhill mountain biking, so, you know, there's that. But one of the really encouraging things I came across were teams of scientists from different disciplines, physical climate scientists and social scientists, working together in Italian mountain communities to help them shape an adaptive and resilient response to global warming. And apparently they're having some success with that, and they're just spending time with people there and, you know, not only laying the science on the table, but creating spaces where people can talk to each other and listen and learn from each other and come up with their own solutions instead of, you know, finger pointing from the outside and saying, you got to change. They're going there and saying, hey, here's the facts. And how what do you think? How are we going to handle this? And I think that's a big part of what we need to start thinking about in general, whether it's water in the Rockies or skiing, is we need to find new ways to talk about this. We need to find people with courage, with vision, with imagination for the future. And there are people like that out there. It's not just doomsayers and or business as usual people. There are lots of smart, especially young people who've grown up with global warming their whole life, who do have ideas. And I think we need to seek them out more and be inclusive and find these voices and amplify them and share them.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Bob Berwin. So, Bob, you spent some time working on Mono Lake restoration in the early 80s, and you've recently returned back to Mono Lake as a journalist. For our listeners around the country who aren't familiar with this beautiful region, why don't you explain what Mono or Mono Lake is and the problems that it's faced in the past and what it's looking like today?
Sure. Mono Lake is a remnant of a huge inland sea that existed after the last ice age. It's just east of Yosemite National Park. It's a salty lake with a relatively simple but very abundant ecosystem. And it was under threat since the 1940s when Los Angeles started diverting water. It blocked off all the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power blocked off all the streams feeding into Mono Lake, and the lake level started dropping. A group of scientists formed the Mono Lake Committee to try and save the lake. And in the early 80s, I was an intern for 2 summers with the Mono Lake Committee working on that effort. And I returned back there with a grant from an organization called the Water Desk, which is part of University of Colorado at Boulder, to do some in-depth reporting on the restoration efforts that have been underway there for about the last 25 or 30 years. At one point in this process, a court decided that Los Angeles wouldn't be allowed to divert any more water unless the lake is at a certain level. So anyway, they turned the streams back on, so to say. The lake started coming back up, and along with that, there's been a really intensive effort to, you know, the lake will kind of take care of itself as the fresh water flows back in to sort of maintain that balance between salt and fresh water. But all these stream beds were dried out for miles. All the vegetation died where the streams had been blocked off, and there have been hundreds of people working in the last couple of decades to try and recreate some of those stream ecosystems. And that was one of the key things that I looked at while we were there, because I think it's a really sort of a a model or lighthouse project, I guess you could call it, a model project for restoration that we could be doing in other places to heal some of the ecological damage that we've caused in the last, 50 to 100 years with over-industrialization, over-exploitation of natural resources.
And yet, kind of like the bald eagle coming back, Mono Lake is a symbol to many that man can actually make a change for the better. If it weren't for the protections that you're describing here, the lake probably would have died during these recent California droughts, right?
From a number of interviews that I did while I was there, the hydrologists, the people who study water levels and water flows, they all seem to agree that based on what they knew about lake levels and stream flows and evaporation and so forth, that the lake would have dropped well below a point that it can support an ecosystem during the big California drought in the mid-2010s. Yeah, that's the consensus. Maybe that's a sign that, as we look to future climate change or future global warming, we need to protect areas and make sure that they have the natural resilience to withstand those changes. A lot of people have said that. I've heard it a lot in the context of marine protected areas, for example, in the oceans. And when I hear about that, it seems kind of abstract. And I always go like, okay, how exactly does that help? And then in the case of Mono Lake, to me, it became, really clear and not abstract. It was like, okay, we stopped the diversions. We let the lake start filling back up, and then when the drought hit in the mid-2010s, there was enough of a buffer there, even with really low stream flows for a few years, that the ecosystem and the lake and the related ecosystems were able to persist through that really dry time.
And speaking of dry time, you've studied some of the groundwater issues that Nevada is facing. Why don't you explain what's going on in the Amargosa River Basin in Nevada?
So, I had the idea of writing a story about what happens to the world's hottest places. And of course, I thought about Death Valley. And interestingly, as we passed through there the first time, the thermometer outside the Furnace Creek Visitor Center, where that all-time record hot global land surface temperature was recorded, was broken, so couldn't tell how hot it was, but it was hot. And as I started to do research for that story, I called up some contacts, and somebody said, well, think about the Amargosa River. It's this crazy underground river that's designated as a wild and scenic river, and it's pretty much all ice age water. It's water that's left over from 15, 20,000 years ago when the big western glaciers melted, and it's still sort of trickling and percolating through the rocks and cracks and pouring around in different directions and so forth. And it's being heavily mined or pumped, I should say, is a better word for water by Las Vegas to, supply growth there. So there are concerns and threats as this is going on. The water table is dropping. Springs are drying up. And of course, in an area like southeastern California and western Nevada, really all the wildlife there is dependent on, a relatively or really small number of springs where that water comes to the surface. And so one scientist that I corresponded with via email pointed to some studies that showed, 50, 75% drops in bird populations in the last 75 years or so, and another guy who grows dates at a little oasis there talked about how the water table and they can measure how deep the water is in the aquifers and how far it goes down every year, and basically the concern is that ice age water is being used unsustainably. And since it dates back to the Ice Age, that implies that once it's gone, it's pretty much gone. It's just gone. It's not going to be replaced anytime soon. It's not going to be replenished by heavy rains in the summer. It's just going to be gone. So something worth thinking about. And that's, of course, an issue that affects other even much more significant underground water resources, the Oglala Aquifer in the central U.S. And places like that.
Now you're out of the U.S. and you're in Oaxaca, Mexico, as we're speaking. You're working on an interesting watershed restoration project, a permaculture pilot project called El Pedregal. What is that?
It's a permaculture site where, after extreme deforestation, the watershed was pretty devastated. Once you chop down all the forests, the water just runs off the surface and, you know, runs away and runs down. So there's a group of people who are working on trying to recreate that watershed and create sustainable agricultural conditions once again.
And did you see any parallels between what you're working on now and what challenges they're facing in the Southern Colorado region, Bob?
Absolutely. Very, very similar challenges in terms of water availability and similar responses. One of the places that we visited on this reporting trip through the Southwest, and we spent quite a bit of time in southwestern Colorado, is a town called Paonia, where people are focused on building a sustainable agricultural community. And one of the folks I spoke with there is working on what he calls an agroforestry project and trying to rebuild the watershed there through planting trees in an area that was logged or where beetles have killed the trees. And not only pine trees, but he's actually working on planting trees that can provide food, so nut trees and fruit trees and things like that, which has kind of multiple benefits of providing a valuable agricultural crop and also helping to maintain groundwater resources and stream flows, shading the ground so that it doesn't bake in the summer sun and those sorts of things. The agroforestry also goes together with planting complementary types of plants, so different types of trees and shrubs also that produce food that grow together in nature, and they maintain sort of a natural soil balance. They don't just use one kind of nutrient all the time, but one plant takes away some nutrients, the other plant kind of rebuilds those same nutrients and just helps maintain a sort of a more natural ecological balance.
Well, thanks for the important work you're doing, and folks will be able to follow your writings on insideclimatenews.com and also can follow you at bberwyn, B-E-R-W-Y-N, on Twitter. Bob Berwyn, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely, Alex. My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The New Master Sounds and Steven Stills. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.